Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. Today, Bob and I are talking about how compliance positions Canna businesses for long-term success, and we are joined by the founder and CEO of Allay Consulting, Kimberly Stuck. Kim, thank you for being here with us this evening.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and there's a lot to cover here as it relates to cannabis compliance and how that interacts with the hemp and marijuana industries. But before we get into that, give us a brief overview of how you got into cannabis compliance. And if you want to, you can tell us about your nickname. You don't have to, though, if you don't want to.
So I originally started my career as a health inspector for the city of Denver. So I did restaurants and wholesale food facilities. And so I'm a certified professional food safety. I'm a certified quality auditor. And that was kind of the beginning of my career. And I had a lot of food safety background. I worked in a lot of restaurants. And then my degree is in human nutrition biochem. So we had to take a whole lot of culinary classes and food safety classes. So it was kind of a perfect fit for me. Once I started working at DDPHE, which was pretty quick after graduation, it became really apparent that cannabis was going to become legal. So we started kind of gearing up towards that. And then when it became recreationally legal in Denver, they kind of realized, you know, that we need to actually be out there and regulating it. And so we kind of developed a way to do that based on the food code that was code that was already existing. And we just applied it to the cannabis industry. And then it got so overbearing, the workload in the cannabis area, because there's a lot of different things about cannabis when it comes to food safety and consumer safety and product safety. And so they eventually offered a position for me to be the like lead cannabis regulator, if you will, for DDPHE. And so obviously I took that because I really was interested in cannabis and I loved it and I thought it was interesting and new and fun. And so I kind of stepped up, did that. We ended up having a whole team of cannabis people on staff, and they still are there and working their butts off to this day, I'm sure. I was kind of the first one through the door. And when I was there, there was a lot of recalls that I had to do because of pesticides mostly. But a lot of it, you know, with contaminated product, mold and mycotoxins and things like that as well. But I had to do a whole lot of recalls. So the nickname was Weed Whacker that somebody gave me in Denver, and it spread like wildfire. And then in 2017, I decided that I wanted to do something different for the industry. I ended up really falling in love with the cannabis industry as a whole. I loved the people. I loved the passion that people had for the plant. And I thought the plant could do amazing things. So I decided to, instead of taking a job in the industry, but to more ethically, hand out my services, if you will, to anyone who would pay for them as a consultant. And so in 2017, I did that and started the firm that I now run.
So, Kim, tell us a little bit about the firm. And we had a conversation previously about the name. So not only tell us a little bit about the name, but define it and use it in a sentence, if you would, because I think it's pretty inspiring.
Well, thank you. So this was just like a brainchild of me and my husband, to tell you the truth. We were just trying to come up with names and came up with a lot of really terrible ones first. And then I kind of landed, I was like, you know, what are we here for, right? We're trying to help owners, you know, sleep better at night and not worry so much that a regulator is going to come in and find them. You know, there's a lot of anxiety around compliance. And so I kind of just like started Googling terms for like relieving anxiety and things like that. And I landed on Allay, and Allay is an English word, and it means to calm or soothe stress or anxiety. And in a sentence I always use to describe it is the ocean breeze allayed my woes. When you're like sitting in front of, on a beach you're, you know, much calmer than probably anywhere else. So yeah, that's why we chose that name, because that's really why we exist, is to help people manage their compliance in their business so that they don't have to think about it and worry about it all the time.
So when the weed whacker left the government employee and began this, what are some of the first things he started to get into? You saw from the other side, and you understood that there was an importance of putting these standards in place, food grade standards, safety standards, stability standards, so forth and so on. And this was basic stuff that happens in every other industry where people eat or consume products. It wasn't par for the course in cannabis, and it's still only improving, even though the rules are required. Tell us a little bit about how you begin to flip those and say to, you know, Company X, you really need to put these in place. It's risk mitigation. It's liability mitigation. Tell us a little bit about that. Not to put words in your mouth, but your spin on how that entry point worked for you.
Yeah. So at first it was a little strange, because I was showing up at happy hours and people recognized me and were like, why is she here? so that, you know, that transition obviously was always hard. But I think that people understand that eventually cannabis, whether, you know, obviously the hemp side of things are already going this way, but it's like Pandora's box, right? We are going to be federally legal eventually. It will happen. I'm very, very confident that it will. And when that happens, a lot of companies are going to be at risk because they aren't in law with FDA or OSHA or International Fire Code, you know, things like that. And, you know, the best way that I can explain it to people is, you know, are you playing just for next month or are you going to play for like years down the road? And if you're a good business owner that understands business and understands, you know, the risk and liability that comes with, you know, product recalls or people making someone sick, they understand that this kind of risk mitigation is absolutely required moving forward. People need to understand, you know, what kind of, you know, food safety policies need to be in place. They need to have, you know, adequate training for their staff, because if there is an incident, they want to be able, and the, you know, Bob, you should probably know this better than I can. We want to prevent them from being sued, essentially. You know, there is so much risk with, you know, when you're handling food and things that are consumable, and even, you know, smoking items as well. So anything that can go wrong, we try to, you know, evaluate those risks and then put procedures in place to mitigate those risks. And I think that explaining it to people in that way, really understand. Anyone that I have been in the door of and, you know, disposing of millions and millions of dollars of product, they will, you know, they're a testament to that. You know, it can definitely put companies out of business. It ruins your brand identity. But if you're prepared for something like that, you know, you can control what happens. If you're, you know, you can do it. Every wholesale food company does voluntary recalls. It's the way of life. You know, if an ingredient gets in one of their ingredients that isn't supposed to be there, like, you know, nuts or something like that, peanuts in flour, then they're going to do a recall. But it doesn't ruin their brand because they do it the correct way, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And you talk about instituting policies, procedures, but also most importantly, record keeping, bookkeeping. Yeah. As a government official, and when you're out there in the field, the very first thing you do is ask for records from specified periods of time if you don't have access to that otherwise, or if that's not required by way of reporting. And that's not an obvious thing for a new business owner in a brand new regulated industry to understand that not only do I have to do these things and put procedures, policies, et cetera, in place, but I need to keep and maintain records, the latter being perhaps the most difficult when you're talking about, you know, information that's compiled and probably pretty thick on a daily basis.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a really amazing point that you just made, because when I was a regulator and doing these recalls, you know, we would find a product that was contaminated. We would take it into the facility and with a batch number. And if they couldn't tell us which batches came from this harvest batch that could potentially have this pesticide, if they couldn't track and couldn't show us documentation on where everything came from and where everything went, then we just assumed that everything in their facility was contaminated because we had no evidence that it wasn't. And so therefore, we would do what we would call an any and all recall, which means that we would recall any and all, everything that they have ever made in their entire facility. We would recall it all. And those were the kind of recalls that would just permanently crush and cripple these businesses. It was terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's wild to think about how operators in this industry, especially in the early years, didn't have a sense that these things were necessary. And that is kind of, you really touched on the theme of the topic of this episode, which is the companies who are actively taking steps to hire a consulting firm like yours that has to do with compliance. Those are the companies that more than likely are going to be here in 10 years, going to outlast this.
The ones that are still here after 10 years, yeah, or thereabout.
You know, then there's so many people out there who are just reactive. So, you know, I think I really like the name because it is this idea about people who are seeking that peace of mind to avoid the kind of risk that comes with not paying attention to these things that, like you're saying, any ingredient producer, any food producer out there, wholesale, these are just common practices. And yet for folks in this industry, it has crushed a lot of businesses. I want to come back to one thing because I know the Colorado regs are changing on January 1st. And so likely there are a lot of businesses here in Colorado who waited until the last minute, who are scrambling right now as other folks are getting ready for Thanksgiving to try to be compliant with these forthcoming regulations. Give us a sense of what those new regulations are and what cannabis owners and operators here in Colorado need to be doing and thinking about to prepare for the new regs in 2021.
Yeah, so the things that our firm are really focusing on and helping a lot of people with, you know, we're excellent at document management and updating SOPs and doing and creating all those kinds of things that companies need for, you know, GMP certification or ISO certification or, you know, just overall compliance. So we've really found that the way that we're best helping people with the regulation change is to build, so now they're requiring a CAPA plan, a recall plan, and a sampling plan in your facilities. And a lot of people, if you're not a food safety expert, it is actually really hard to build a CAPA plan, which is a corrective action, preventive action plan. And it's essentially kind of like a guide for your employees on what to do if, you know, something happens to the product. If they're, you know, like what are the steps of, you know, a recall and how do we change our processes in a way that prevents that from happening again? And it's, you know, they're really complicated. I think our shortest one we've ever written was about 14 pages. So they're kind of complicated. They're part of like a regular food safety plan, but it's just like one section of a food safety plan. And then the recall plan, it's the same thing. It's a guidebook on if we have to do a recall, what do we do? Who do we call? Who do we reach out to, you know, help us in this? And, you know, how do we identify if something needs to be recalled or not? Because a lot of times with the procedures we put in place, we catch incidents before the product gets sold to the public. And if you can catch it before it gets sold to the public, then you don't necessarily have to do a recall. You just have to destroy the product that was contaminated. And that's always the goal from a food safety standpoint. And then the sampling plan is exactly what it sounds like. It's the plan. It's a step-by-step guide for employees and for regulators to understand how you do your sampling. It sounds really simple, and it should be, but it does get a little complicated if you don't know what you're doing. So those are the three things that we're really, you know, kind of last minute throwing together for a lot of people. We've been trying to push it all year long, but no matter what, people kind of wait till the last minute, I feel like.
Well, it's remarkable how far things have come. You touched on earlier some of the challenges in the cannabis industry in Colorado and elsewhere related to pesticides, recall issues, some of the items you just talked about. But, you know, to think back when the legislature enacted the enabling legislation, which delegated that authority to the Create the Med, and ultimately, even prior to that, with the CDPHE sort of overseeing the medical marijuana card issuance and the registry in a sense, and how those things transition from one to another. It's pretty remarkable that we've come this far. But to think that there weren't even dosage requirements on edibles in previous iterations of this industry in the early years. I mean, to the point where, Eric, now these were days where you could walk in and buy, you know, a slice of pumpkin pie that was literally pumpkin pie, but, you know, there might have been 200 milligrams of THC in it. There were these Chiba Chews that were called Decadoses, which a small little piece of candy with 100 milligrams of THC. And, you know, that even the most seasoned cannabis consumer, that is tremendously powerful. So in any event, it's really exciting. But what do you see? I know you guys work in the cannabinoid field, generally speaking, too, as it relates to hemp. What do you see coming down the pipe there? We talk a lot about what I've dubbed regulatory chaos. When you look at the global picture, right? You've got the United Nations and the World Health Organization seemingly making progress and recommendations, but no changes have been enacted yet, although there's some very important votes coming up in December and in March in the short term. You've got the EU going from a novel foods designation akin to a, you know, new dietary ingredient to a potential narcotic treatment. The UK doing something different. Italy saying we're going to treat it like a novel food, not like a narcotic. The United States is kind of just fumbling through right now, gathering safety data. The point is, it's hard to keep up. And this is one element of the industry that is unequivocally global in its sense for commerce. So what do you see? How does this all get shaken out? And, you know, what's the first domino that falls in your mind?
So, you know, the FDA obviously is going to implement regulations. But, you know, they're not writing these regulations from scratch. They're not going to reinvent the wheel with this. It is, you know, food safety is food safety. You can evaluate any process, and I can punch holes in the whole process from a food safety standpoint. That's just the way that it works. And so what they're probably going to do is either choose whether they're going to call it a food ingredient or a supplement. And then they'll take those already existing regulations, CFR 111 and CFR 117, and apply those to the industry. And then they'll probably write a small chapter on, you know, cannabis that talks about, you know, testing and dosing and that sort of thing. The way that it sounded to me, because I do, you know, reach out to the FDA pretty often and have some good contacts there, the way that it's kind of sounding to me is this is kind of their trial run for the THC industry, because they're also seeing down the line and realizing that, you know, cannabis, THC cannabis, is going to eventually be federally legal. Let's try it with this hemp stuff first and see how it goes. And so, you know, I think that's the way that they're going to do it. I know that they're not going to reinvent the wheel. That would be ridiculous. Food safety is food safety. And so I think that's the way they're going to do it. And then once that goes for a while, I'm sure there will be, you know, issues that come up, you know, dealing with Delta 9 issues, dealing with, you know, Delta 8 issues, sorry. It just depends, right? They're going to run into stuff and try to fix it. And then when THC becomes legalized, I believe that they're going to use that same groundwork that they made for, like, the other cannabinoids and then, you know, implement that, because obviously they'll do the same thing, dosing, child-proof packaging, that kind of thing. When it comes to CBD and, you know, the EU and all that, we're kind of seeing trends where they want to make it a global market. Almost every country is kind of trying to balance things in a way, like increasing the EU THC level from 0.2 to 0.3 just recently. You know, that is an obvious, like, hey, we want to be with the United States on this so that we can trade back and forth, right, and make it easier. That makes sense. And I think it's going to be the same in that any other ingredient or supplement where to sell internationally, your company is going to at least have to adhere to ISO 9001 and ISO 22000 in order to sell internationally. And that's, you know, that's in every industry. You know, that's not a weird standard. And when we talk about GMP, GMP is like, you know, the hot new buzzword that everybody wants, right? And not that many people actually have. And GMP is base level. It is like the lowest rung in the ladder of food safety compliance and like QA compliance. And so, you know, then you do ISO 9001 on top of that, and then you can get ISO 22000. And then that's, you know, safe to international standards, usually, depending on the country, obviously. But
how many people do you talk to that don't even know that you can get GMP certified if you are in the hemp CBD, hemp derived sector?
A lot of people ask me that. In fact, a lot of times I'll, you know, get on a call because someone's like, oh yeah, we heard that you guys were great. We want to like talk to you about getting GMP certification. And we'll explain it to them, how we work, how the process goes, how much it costs, you know, all this stuff. And then I'll get an email the next day that says, hey, I heard that you can't actually get this. And I'm like, why would I tell you that you can if you can't, you know? I've even had people, you know, I'm on a lot of the like CDPHC science and policy board, and I was part of the CHAMP initiative and that kind of thing. Even in the CHAMP initiative, I was talking about GMP standards, and sure enough, somebody was like, you can't even get that. And I was like, no, that's what we do. We've done it for several companies. Like, I think that people are still kind of, because it wasn't available for so long, I think that a lot of people, you know, still don't think they can get it, which is, you know, crazy to me because I feel like I shout it from the rooftop. But yeah, I mean, it's still confusing to people. And a lot of times they just don't even know what it is. So that's also a problem.
So I want to make sure that we get your perspective on one more thing, just because you come from a very interesting background where you have all of this experience working for regulatory agencies, state regulatory agencies, and you got to see essentially the birth of this industry and be part of the regulatory framework creation that now guides it. So we saw in Oregon psilocybin legalization to some degree. And so I'm interested as someone with your background and what you saw here in the early days in Colorado in 2012, what do you think it will be like for regulators in Oregon who have to craft regulations for this new thing that is sprung from night into sun?
Yeah. One thing I will applaud them for is they did leave time for them to build regulations. I felt like in Colorado, it was just legal and we didn't even have time to like create regulations before people just started selling. And that's exactly what, you know, Bob was talking about with, you know, I would go into places and there'd be brownies that were just wrapped in cellophane that were made at somebody's house with who knows how much THC in them, you know, for a long time, and that was the way that it was. And so it was really hard for us to scramble and kind of put that back, you know, behind the fence, if you will, and try to like, you know, reel people in a little bit into following regulations. So I think that was good. They gave themselves, you know, over a year, I think, of time to put together regulations. I think that it's going to be very hard for them, as it was for us to write regulations, just because, you know, you have to educate yourself on, you know, the actual, like, psilocybin itself and how, you know, how mushrooms are grown and what kind of food safety standards and public health standards exist in the, you know, edible mushroom realm on top of, you know, all the other stuff to have to do with the chemical and you know, psychoactive and dosing and that kind of thing. They're going to have to get testing labs up to date and know what they're doing. You know, I'm really hoping to be a part of that writing of those regulations. We'll see if I can get in there and try to help them out. But I think they're going to run into a lot of the same issues that we ran into when writing regulations in Colorado from the beginning. There's just going to be some holes because it's a completely brand new industry and you just never know what you're going to do. I mean, people are very creative. They come up with all kinds of products that, you know, I remember being a regulator and going in and seeing infused tampons for the first time. And I was like completely blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, how do we even regulate this? Like, I don't even like know what to do right now, you know? And I think we're going to run into a whole lot of that. So I'm hoping that they put together a group of, you know, industry people and experts and doctors and, you know, scientists to try to help put together those kinds of regulations. It's worked really well in Colorado when they do that, and in Oregon and other states as well. And I think that that's probably their best bet.
Well, no, that's you make an interesting point. And Eric, before you bring us home, I wanted to just let me paint a picture for you. So legislation is passed in early 2010 in Colorado, enacting a regulatory state structured system because the dispensaries had opened prior to state legislation, let alone state regulation. All right. So the legislative session in 2010 begins in January, lasts, I think, till May 1st, right? So then this legislation passes on May 1. So then they created a brand new agency, which was, you know, a couple of people from within the Department of Revenue who had regulated tough industries before and veterans on that side. They had to create rules by July 1. So they had 60 days to do for the government to create an agency and do something within 60 days so there was like, it created a standard whereby on July 1st, the businesses in the space had to file something. And this is also just on the heels of it just being enacted. Then you had a new set of rules that came out between July 1 and August 1. And then you had a new set of rules that came out for further registrations. You had to be, you know, there were these notions of being 7-1, 8-1, 9-1 compliant because the rules would literally were being created and then put out into the marketplace as in real time. It was just remarkable. But to your point, having the benefit of slowly and methodically working through regs and using existing standards is really nice to see these days, because that was madness for the business owners, for all the service providers, like lawyers and whatnot, and yourself, and for the government as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was crazy back then. It was, I'm glad I lived through it because it was so interesting to see. But oh my gosh, it was chaotic. For sure.
Well, Kim, you certainly are an industry veteran and really an OG. And on that note, I want to make sure that we highlight that you will be speaking on the OG panel at the Emerge Cannabis Conference on December 17th. Anybody who's interested can go to emergecanna.com to learn more and register for that event. And then for anybody who owns a cannabis business or operates in this space who does want to mitigate their risk, have some peace of mind, and really position themselves for being in this industry and sticking around for the next 10 years, which, gosh, who knows what the future holds, but it does look pretty bright. Recommend going to alayconsulting.com to learn more and get in touch with Kim and her team. But thank you so much for coming on to the Hoban Minute and sharing your knowledge and expertise with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.